From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. The meeting came as somewhat of a surprise. Tillerson's public schedule included just a meeting with Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. That meeting also happened in New York today. As these diplomatic efforts were taking place in Moscow, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said Russia should side with the civilized world on Syria. The U.S. is trying to ramp up pressure on Moscow to abandon Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after last week's chemical attack that prompted an American military strike on a Syrian airbase. Earlier today, Putin told Russian TV that the relationship between the U.S. and Russia has worsened since President Trump took office in January. Joining us now is David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. And David, there's a lot swirling around right now regarding the U.S. and Russia, but is Putin upping the ante with these comments aimed at Trump?
He's keeping the pressure where it's been. Russia has never acknowledged that Syria had chemical weapons. The Syrian government has never acknowledged that they used them. And they've always said since the first news of the missile strike broke last week that the strike was a violation of international law and that it was, a violation by the United States of the understanding over Syria. So the fact that they're wheeling that out again today is nothing other than a sign that they don't intend to respond to Tillerson's ultimatum, basically, that Russia had better choose sides.
Is Russia determined, though, to maintain support for President Assad? Is that, in a way, a red line for Russia?
It's not about President Assad so much. And my own belief is that Putin was badly hurt, not his feelings, but his strategy, by the use of chemical weapons. It really threw a wrench in his works. Because the big picture here is that Putin, especially during the interregnum there between the Obama administration and when Trump started getting engaged, Putin had set up this peace process where Russia was the leader and Iran was in on it and Turkey was in on it and the Kurds were in on it. He was saying to the world, hey, look, I'm Putin. I'm not trying to topple leaders. I'm trying to get everybody on board and form consensus. Come to Russia when you want something done. And that's the issue here. To pull out right now is to say that that whole process was built on a false premise and that whole process is going to collapse. And Putin's big project for 2017, after he won 2016, is, kaput.
But you're saying that Assad took Putin by surprise with the chemical attack, because there are some in this country who believe that they both knew what was about to happen.
I mean, the Russians like to make arguments like this. What they say is, how would it be possible for Assad to use chemical weapons? He was winning the war. I'm going to use that same logic. Why in the world would Russia, knowing that it's got the upper hand, the United States is disinterested and disengaged, you brought all these people together, you've got Iran working with you, for crying out loud, hey, let's do a chemical weapons attack and get everybody involved and then try to cover it up. I'm pretty sure that what happens here is that Assad, being an irrational actor, decides to, go for it with the chemical weapons, and then Russia is stuck with an ally that has just put it in that position. Everything we've been seeing since then is backpedaling. Look at what Putin said. He said, I have information that there's going to be another provocation where someone's going to put chemical weapons somewhere and then blow it up and blame the Assad government. This is classic. This is classic, changing the focus and muddying the waters and making you wonder what's true, what's not true. That's a classic defense when you have nowhere to go. You say, yeah, that may or may not have happened, but look at something worse is going to happen too.
What about the relationship between the U.S. and Russia right now? There are people talking about a new Cold War.
It was never as good as people thought it was going to be when, Trump got elected and all that stuff about not criticizing Putin and everything. You always knew, and I've said it on these airwaves, that, it's one confrontation away from it being, the disruptor in chief versus the disruptor in chief. So on this level, on the upper level, I'm sure that the Kremlin was always very wary about things getting any better. Obama was predictable. Obama was a traditional American president. Obama wasn't going to do anything like just roll in and start firing cruise missiles without any warning, right? So on the level of, this is much worse of a crisis than we had, a week ago when there weren't cruise missiles being lobbed at Syria. Yeah, it's worse. But as far as tensions now are worse than they were in, November or January, the situation never got off the ground. There was a little bit of optimism. But what we've got right now is, you know, we were on the bottom. There was a dead cat bounce and we're still on the bottom. Mm. And now we're trying to see if we can go any lower.
That's David Filipov, Washington Post Moscow bureau chief, talking to us on a big day, although it seems like almost every day is a big day in U.S.-Russian relations. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, each year, thousands sign up on organ donor lists hoping to get a life-saving liver or kidney. We've talked before on this program about attempts to create these much-needed organs in the lab. There have also long been attempts to create them in pigs, the animal most similar to humans. And now the biotech firm eGenesis is picking up where drug companies left off, working to create genetically designed piglets whose organs could be harvested for humans. The work is raising hope and questions. Sharon Begley has taken a look. She's a senior science writer with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Sharon, we'll get to the ethical questions, but start with the practical, because huge drug companies like Novartis have tried this, spent something like $2 billion and failed.
Well, they did. There was a huge effort in the 90s to somehow create pigs whose organs would be transplantable safely and effectively into people. And the reason that effort foundered is that pigs contain a lot of viruses, their genes do. And therefore, if you transplant, let's say, a pig liver into a person, there was a real risk, according to federal regulators, scientists, physicians, that those viruses would then infect the person. So that work just died.
And so they've had to do genetic altering at eGenesis to try to rid the embryos that they're implanting in these sows to try to stop that transmission of the viruses?
Exactly. The reason this has taken off again is that the genome editing technology CRISPR, which I know we have mm-hmm. talked about mm-hmm. before, has been developed so that it can go into a pig cell and literally wipe out all 62 of the viruses that were the concern a couple of decades ago. So that was the first step that eGenesis has had to take. But it's going further. It's going to insert up to 12 human genes into the soon-to-be pigs, the embryos, so that the resulting animals and therefore their organs are even more human-like. For instance, they would be more like humans in terms of the coagulation system and the immune system so that the organs would be, again, more effective and certainly safe if they are ever transplanted.
Well, you spoke with Luhan Yang, who is the Chinese-born scientist who's at the forefront of this work. One of her concerns, so many people in China, I think 2 million, are awaiting transplants, and there are special issues in China that make this problem even more profound there. One is that there's an objection to being buried without your body parts, so they have fewer donors. But she's very aware of the ethical questions as well. What are they?
Well, she really is. And to her credit, she has reached out to ethicists, to physicians, to lawyers about creating designer pigs for human transplant. And one, of course, is just the basic. You are going to be killing all of these pigs for the sake of human health and life. And, you know, she recognizes that. And the sort of hard, extreme animal rights movement says that that's wrong, that there is no ethical justification for killing animals for human health. You know, you can take that position, but I would then point you to virtually any restaurant menu. So as long as we are a society that eats other animals, that really seems to be one that is not going to gain much traction. Another one is a religious objection. At least two of the world's major religions view pigs as unclean, and therefore using their parts would not be acceptable. On the other hand, both Judaism and Islam have said that if it is a matter of saving a human life, then it is okay to have, for instance, pig heart valves, which are currently transplanted. Anyway, so to her credit, Luhan has grasped and grappled with all of these. Her basic position is if you object to this, that is a personal choice, whether you use a pig organ or not, but you should not prevent other people from using one and having a chance at life.
And so how close is eGenesis to a replacement liver or a kidney?
Not all that close. So I hung out with the eugenicist scientists for a number of months. And their main problem right now is, as you described, Robin, they create the cells, the embryos, in a lab, and then they transplant them into surrogate mother pigs, sows. Unfortunately, they have had a lot of miscarriages, probably because the genetic changes that they have made to the embryos are so extreme that they just result in these miscarriages. So the eugenicist scientists have got to solve that problem, because if you are going to be a going concern, and remember, this is a private company, it hopes to be a for-profit company, it raised $38 million a couple of months ago, it can't have so many of its embryos being miscarried. So that really is a challenge. So I would say not before 5 years, and maybe at least 10 years out.
That's Sharon Begley, senior science writer with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Sharon, we'll be watching. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's here and now. After the high-profile deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Eric Garner on Staten Island, Tamir Rice in Cleveland, and so many others at the hands of police, there was a call for police to wear body cameras so that if there's an incident, it's easier to determine exactly what happened and hold people accountable. Well, now the company Axon, formerly known as Taser, is offering body cameras to any police department for free for a year. Joining us now is Steve Tuttle, one of the founding members of the company. He serves as Axon's Vice President of Strategic Communications. Steve, welcome.
Good to be here.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten to this offer so far?
So far, it's been tremendous. Lots of accolades from various chiefs of police of varying sizes, particularly the big ones that know that this is an expensive proposition, but just as importantly from the small teams out there that really want access to try these cameras for a year and really kick the tires and see what this thing can do.
And how much would it cost them to keep them after that year?
Well, roughly, we're providing about $1,500 worth of services and the hardware. But if they want to keep them, then they would purchase the $399 worth of hardware, and they would then be set up on a plan for Evidence.com that could run anywhere from $15 a month up to $89.
And Evidence.com is owned by Axon, right? And that's where you store the data.
That's where all the information is not only just stored, but it's managed and it's also redacted and creates chains of custodies and becomes shareable with the click of a button to district attorneys.
What was the reason for making this offer to have free body cameras for a year?
Well, 21st century policing recommendations that came out recently have really applauded the effects of body-worn cameras. And where it's been effective is when it's been put on all the patrol officers. And we're seeing less use of force and less complaints against officers. So given the transparency issues going on, this is just a tremendous value proposition for the agencies, but they have to field test it to really know the value of it.
And body cameras, by the way, are how common at this point at police departments across the country?
Roughly 1 in 5 police officers in the United States have body-worn cameras. We happen to have 36 of the 68 largest cities in America that deploy them, but we know that more need them. And if we're putting a gun on every officer, why not put a camera on them as well?
Now, there are some critics of this idea, or basically of your company, because they believe you've got too much control. If you control all of the information coming off of those body cameras all across the country, that a private company has too much control over something that should be decided by the police departments.
Well, that actually couldn't be further from the truth. We simply store our videos in Microsoft Azure, and that's a tier 1 cloud provider using our software code. And so they actually control the destiny of all of their evidence because they actually own it by law.
But you have access to all of it.
We don't have access to it unless they give us permission to go into certain areas. Now, we do monitor performance, which anybody would be doing on any type of cloud service to make sure that the systems are up and running. But we would have to get explicit information just to check certain files for them. And so they literally control that information on their own. You know, it's just like getting Windows and Microsoft, you know, lets you use those Word documents any way you want to, and you control those documents.
What about the process of getting them? That's another criticism I've seen that, you know, many police departments are required to go through a competitive bidding process before they secure contracts for body cameras. In this case, you're saying, no, just take them for free from us right now and you can figure out the rest later.
That's sort of a way that you can look at it, but you can also look at this as looking at an arcane process for looking at technology. And instead of just passing off a brochure and doing a PowerPoint and hiring lobbyists to pitch which cameras work best, you need to put the technology in the hands of the users. So we're simply saying, we're going to put our money where our mouth is and say, you can test these cameras now for free at no charge, no gimmick. And we encourage all of our competitors to do the same thing and try these cameras side by side to see if they're a fit for your agency.
Do you think that police departments are doing enough after they decide to either take your cameras for free or buy cameras to decide when they're going to be turned on, how often they're going to be used, all the rules of the road after they have the body cameras? Because some believe that they're not doing that well enough.
Well, it comes down to having good policies that are thoughtful and pragmatic and have good oversight. We've seen instances where we can actually leverage the technology to have these cameras turn on as well. So we have certain systems called Axon Signal. Now, that allows cameras to be notified that there's an event occurring, and the cameras would then turn on. But good policy will tell you when to turn those cameras on, and particularly it's when there's public interaction or if you get a radio call.
Do you see body cameras as something that other professions could use?
Yes, I do. And you're looking at private security, but you're also looking at, we've seen some calls for this for firemen to show up on scene, play back the video, and sometimes they can see where fires are emanating from. So we will be getting into more public safety, but we're really not going too far out of our lanes. We're really hyper-focused on staying with public safety and the law enforcement, military, and possibly into fire.
That's Steve Tuttle, who's one of the founding members of the company Axon, formerly known as Taser. He is currently the Vice President of Strategic Communications. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now for a critic. Elizabeth Joe is a law professor at the University of California, Davis, who's written widely about policing, technology, and surveillance. Elizabeth Joe, you're not a big fan of this idea of one company giving out body cams to police departments across the country. Why not?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm not a big fan, but I think that I'm skeptical about it. So let's step back for a moment. Go back to August 2014 when we had the protests in Ferguson. So a lot of people think, well, what do we do to make sure we can address some of the issues of policing that we saw there in the protests after the shooting of Mike Brown? Well, one thought was we could have body cameras as a tool of accountability to make sure that we would have a record of what happened. And so lots of police departments wanted to embrace this idea that body cameras can be a good tool. The issue here is that a tool like a body camera is only as accountable as the policies around it and the way in which the product is actually designed. So that means two things. On the guideline or policy level, it really depends on what the laws and the departmental guidelines say about it. So we know that states have been slowly trying to come up with ways of regulating police body cameras, but there's variation all over the map. Laws that deal with everything from in what situation should police use their body cameras, how long should the data be stored, who can have access to the data. These are all fundamental questions that local jurisdictions have had a slow start to addressing in any systematic way. But a hidden part of this is that actually the companies that make the products, the body cameras themselves, have a huge influence over how that product is actually used by the police. Because after all, think of it this way. When it comes to a police body camera, police departments are customers. They're not in the driver's seat. And what really matters is what are the design features, not just of the body camera itself, but the more important thing, the storage of the data itself, who has access to it, what kind of software is going to be used for that data.
Well, what are your concerns there? What do you think that a company like Axon is going to do with that data in a way that makes you uncomfortable?
Well, first of all, one of the things, you know, my understanding is that the CEO of Taser / Axon has announced that one of the things he'd like to see in future uses of body camera technology is facial recognition software. That's a really good example because communities around the country have expressed concern. They thought, well, first of all, we thought the police body camera was going to be a tool of police accountability. Is it also turning into a tool of police surveillance? And if that's the case, who will make these decisions. The problem here is when there's one company that's dominant and that one company already makes that technological decision for you, well, that's something that is done not in a democratic fashion, but a private company making that choice. And that's the kind of thing that should trouble us, because we want local communities to have a say in how these kinds of new technologies, and let's call them surveillance technologies, are being used.
It sounds like you're saying, in some cases, you'd rather no body camera at all, even if it were, you know, operated by the police department, than all of these additional body cameras being sent out to police departments across the country.
No, I'm not sure that I'm saying that. What I am saying is I think that we really need to have a conversation about, you know, why are we having this swift adoption on the one hand without enough prior regulation in place? And number two, why isn't there more competition in the private body camera market? And here's the case where the first mover is critical. I'll ask you a question, and that is, can you name any other stun gun maker than Taser?
No.
You probably can't.
I can.
So the first mover here is really critical. So it seems to me highly unlikely that if a police department adopts Axon cameras for this free offer, is there really any chance they're going to adopt another company later, another company's body cameras? It seems highly unlikely here. And the problem, furthermore, is that with Taser, it's a private company. They're not beholden to the local communities that are served by local police departments. If you're a concerned citizen, you want to find out something about what Taser is doing, what new technologies are they going to apply to the data, how can you find out? They don't have to tell you. They're not public entities that are subject to state records laws. And that kind of secrecy is very much against the idea that body cameras were all about a couple of years ago, when this could have been a very promising tool. It still can be, but it's rolling out in circumstances that I think are very troubling.
That's Elizabeth Joe, who is a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Good to be with you.
Hi, it's Robin Young. Before we get back to the program, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Here and Now, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous. It's easy. It'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. It'll be tremendously helpful to us, so thanks. Across the country, property is often passed down from generation to generation without legal paperwork. That's especially true of African Americans in the South. It's known as heirs property, and it can create a host of home ownership problems. Sam Whitehead from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting has our story.
Camille McKnight has spent many an afternoon on the front porch of her small white house in Porterdale, Georgia.
My granddad lived here, and he moved, and then my parents moved down in this house.
McKnight, who's 80, grew up here in Rose Hill, a neighborhood built a century ago for African American workers at the local cotton mill. Rose Hill hasn't aged well. Many of the homes haven't been kept up to code, and some sit empty, slowly dissolving into the woods.
If we don't get no help up in here, I just wonder, would it be a Rose Hill?
In 2013, the city tried to help. It won a $250,000 grant to fix up homes in Rose Hill. But the plan hit a snag.
You couldn't get the grant because the person named the house in had to be living.
Like others in Rose Hill, McKnight's home was still in her parents' name, not hers. And because of that, the grant fell through.
At that time, not anyone owned their property outright.
Terry Gray is a member of the Porterdale City Council. She's chuckling because in this day and age, that's hard to believe.
Even though you lived in the house and you say, well, in my Bible or I have a letter, that's fine. But when it comes to grants and taxes, the property needs to be in your name.
Gray saw cleaning up property titles as the key to saving Rose Hill. Helping in that effort is Delene Porter from the Georgia Heirs Property Law Center.
It doesn't matter whether you are trying to completely transform and remake a neighborhood or you're trying to preserve a neighborhood. Title is kind of at the root of whether you'll be successful in either case.
The nonprofit works to help folks like Camille McKnight, who's one of their clients, prove they own their homes. Porter says it's no small feat.
It's the two most complicated things. It's land and family.
First, you have to track down every relative with a claim to the property. Then make sure they don't want it. Porter says the process can take years.
The fact that people own heirs' property to begin with reflects some historical factors.
Thomas Mitchell studies heirs' property at Texas A&M. He says it's hard to know exactly how big the problem is nationwide, but says you can find heirs' property anywhere you find marginalized groups of people.
For example, right after the end of the Civil War, African-American property owners were denied legal services in many places throughout this country.
Mitchell says heirs' property is a problem you'll find mostly in Native American and immigrant communities, among the urban and rural poor, and in former mill towns like Porterdale. Back on her front porch, Camille McKnight wonders about the future of Rose Hill and her home.
After I'm gone, even though the house is not in my name, I just wish somebody in the family, you know, would carry on.
But that hope might be in vain. McKnight says she doesn't have a will and hasn't discussed the matter with her children. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
One of the holiest sites in Christianity fully reopens to the public this Easter Sunday after a year-long renovation. It's the tomb where Jesus is believed to have been laid after his crucifixion and where, according to Christian belief, he was resurrected after death. The tomb is inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Fred Hebert is an archaeologist in residence at the National Geographic Society and a member of the team that took part in renovating the tomb. Fred, welcome to Here and Now.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And is it true, first of all, that it took more than 50 years for all of the branches of the Christian church to agree on the renovations?
Yeah, it takes a long time for agreements to happen at the church because there are so many stakeholders. The original agreement to renovate the edicule, the central shrine in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, was done in 1959.
Wow.
It takes a long time. That's not really considered a long time in church time.
Well, how do we know that this is Jesus' tomb?
Well, we don't know. There's the science of history, and there's the science of conservation at play here. And then there's a certain amount of faith that's involved. If you believe that that's the spot, we have a lot of information to add to our knowledge about that spot now, because we actually had a chance to open up that innermost shrine.
Well, let's talk about what it looks like in there. I visited back in November. This is in the old city of Jerusalem. You go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So you're in a church, and then within that church is the tomb.
That's correct. And it's been that same location since about the 4th century A.D. At that time, the 4th century, that part of Jerusalem was outside of town. It was outside of the city walls in an area that was not abandoned, but it had been used as a quarry and then it had been used as a cemetery. When the Romans came into town in Jerusalem, they actually built a temple to Aphrodite there. It was kind of like marked the spot with the first Christian church. Constantine era, the 4th century AD, they were looking for something tangible, and they interviewed the people. They kind of extracted information, doing what we would call oral histories, and then actually digging some stuff up. They put the church there, and that's the shrine. Since the 4th century AD, it's been like that. What you see today is really quite remarkably different. It's in the old Christian quarter of Jerusalem. It's surrounded by a giant bazaar, covered bazaar. It's like one of the oldest parts of town. And the church doors are open. And you think, wow, that's pretty unusual after being in this closed, covered bazaar. This is not only an ancient site, but you obviously feel the reverence of the hundreds and hundreds of pilgrims that are there today.
Well, and it's actually not very far away within the church from another important site when it comes to the history of Jesus.
That's correct. And there's the place of the crucifixion, and it's all under one roof. And then you walk from that hilltop down maybe about 100 feet, and you get to the shrine to the tomb. It's absolutely an amazing sound space, and the scent of candles and the song of Gregorian chants done by the monks is an incredible experience being inside. Up until the renovation of the Edicule, it was also one of the darkest, dingiest places I'd ever visited.
Hmm. Well, and what exactly did you have to do during the renovation? What was the point of it?
Well, we were there. National Geographic was there following the conservation of an amazing group of Greek conservators who had really made their name putting in some renovations at the Acropolis, but also helping to stabilize the famous basilica in modern-day Istanbul called Hagia Sophia. So they were invited here to Jerusalem to do pretty much the same thing, except for one extra caveat, and that is that they had to do all of their renovations and conservations while it was still actively being used as a pilgrimage.
Right. And one of the things that the renovations did was to remove iron girders put up by the British in 1947 to support sagging walls.
That's right. The thing about the church is that today it's not only a church and a shrine, it's also a monastery. There's like 50 monks that live there, and they all have to agree on everything. So that's one of the reasons that it takes so long to make decisions about renovations or who gets to sweep what tile or who gets to change what light bulb. Everything takes a long time.
So one of the things that I know was discovered during the renovations is that the ground beneath the church and the tomb is unstable. Is the building at risk of collapse?
Well, there's a lot to learn by doing these studies. We're just getting the data in. We have 21st century sort of non-invasive techniques being used, radar, LIDAR, thermography, to look deep through the walls and into the ground. It's our first time to actually sort of have the chance to see underground without actually having to dig anything. The problem is that there are a lot of tunnels, and the area was an ancient quarry 2,000 years ago. So there's an urgency to start repairing what is underneath.
But an urgency, as we spoke about, could mean 50 more years of negotiations before a new renovation could start.
I think they got the bug to start doing things a little bit quicker. The amazing thing about this particular project is that as the Edicule was conserved and it started to be cleaned and you could start seeing the black going to beautiful crystalline white marble and the inscriptions going around, everybody who's a stakeholder became more and more enthused. We just had the final ceremony, the handoff of the church, of the Edicule back to the church, and I never saw so many black-robed patriarchs smiling so big.
Hmm. Well, the other amazing thing about this site that you were working on is that you are just steps away at, you know, one of the holiest sites in Christianity. You are steps away from the holiest site in Judaism and one of the holiest sites in Islam.
It's absolutely true. It was sort of an astonishing thing for an archaeologist like myself who is frequently in Egypt or working along the Silk Road to come to a place where in the Holy Lands, everything is relatively close to each other. All of Jerusalem is like that. I mean, you've got the holiest churches in the Christian quarter, which are, you know, a couple hundred feet away from some of the holiest places in Judaism and in Islam, probably the holiest square mile in the world.
After spending so long right next to Jesus' tomb, did it mean much to you at the end of it, or did it just seem like another day at work?
No, I tell you, it was really one of the more extraordinary experiences in my life as an archaeologist. I spent this spring sort of visiting Tutankhamun's tomb in the Valley of the Kings. And that's more of a typical day for me where you go into one of these ancient sites and, okay, so it's 3,000 years old. That's like cool. And you're by yourself and it's sort of like you're communing with the past, right? In this case, you're communing with the past in the Church of the Holy Edicule And at the same time, you've got pilgrims everywhere. You've got some of them are in deep ecstasy. And you've got monks who are coming out and praying and incense and candles. And it's just such a different living space. It's a unique experience.
That's Fred Hebert, who is an archaeologist in residence at the National Geographic Society, part of the team that took part in renovating the tomb of Jesus in Jerusalem. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And let's now hear the sound of the monks that Fred was talking about of the Greek Orthodox Church who are based at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Listening to Here and Now.
Our congratulations to all the Pulitzer Prize winners announced this week, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and of course, Art Cullen. You may not know that name, but his is an important voice in Northwest Iowa, where his family-run newspaper, the Storm Lake Times, serves 3,000 subscribers twice a week. Art won the Pulitzer for editorial writing, the committee citing his tenacious reporting that successfully challenged powerful corporate agricultural interests in Iowa. And Art Cullen joins us from the paper's office in Storm Lake. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, we'll take up whether or not you feel successful. I want to hold on to that word from the committee. But first, tell us what this was about, a lawsuit brought by the Des Moines Waterworks against three counties there over the nitrogen runoff from farm drainage systems into rivers that supply drinking water. Big problem in farming country. What was the heart of the matter to you? What did you want to get at in your editorials?
First off, we were trying to provide for transparency in government financing. The Agribusiness Association of Iowa and the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation both set up a fund to cover the legal expenses that these three counties, Buena Vista, Sac, and Calhoun counties, and their drainage districts were listed as defendants in this lawsuit. And so this corporate agribusiness account was set up to cover their legal expenses, which ran into the millions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, you worked with the Iowa Freedom of Information Council to force the release of the documents that showed that the county's fight against the lawsuit was funded by the Farm Bureau, the lobbying group, and other groups. But you talk about the funding. It gets kind of nutty, really important to people there. But the overarching point was what?
Well, in terms of the funding, that the public should understand who was financing the defense so we could understand how that defense was being shaped. Mm. That was the main issue to us, was transparency. These were public records, and we sought them in conjunction with the Iowa Freedom of Information Council.
But then, if I've got this right, the thinking was to maybe shift some of the burden of fixing this problem of runoff to a sales tax, which you explained in one beautiful opening paragraph, how that would impact people there. Have I got this right?
Yeah. Governor Terry Branstad had hoped to, there is a statewide school sales tax, a 1 cent per dollar sales tax that's devoted to school construction. And we have a burgeoning school population here because we're a meatpacking town and we have a lot of young immigrant families in our schools. We got kids coming out the windows. So the governor had proposed to take that school sales tax and devote it to water quality.
Well, in fact, could you read us the opening paragraph of one of your editorials? It begins with the corn and the soybeans. It explains this interconnection.
Right. The corn and soybeans, whose fertilization fouls the Raccoon River, which emanates in Buena Vista County near Marathon, are fed to hogs that young men and women slaughter at Tyson Fresh Meats in Storm Lake. Those young men and women have started families at a pace we could not envision when the middle school was built in 1992. Their children are jamming the classrooms.
I mean, it's just such a beautiful way of reminding people why the schools are overcrowded, because these companies are demanding more and more workers. But then you go on to explain why raising the sales tax would not impact big agriculture, but would affect those very families. Could you read that paragraph?
The workers at Tyson who buy school supplies for their children would find their sales tax payments going to ag landowners who install bioreactors while living in California and paying no sales tax in Iowa. And Storm Lake could not afford to build the size of facility it needs to accommodate the children of food processors woven into the supply chain that pollutes the Raccoon River directly and indirectly.
Yeah. Look, you've won the Pulitzer, and the committee says that you successfully, you know, brought this argument. But a judge threw out the lawsuit from the water facility against the three counties in March.
Correct.
Do you feel that you've won?
Yeah, because we got secret dark money accounts shut down. That's the most important thing to take out of this. We got dark money out of our courts.
These were the lobbying groups that were backing the county's fight against the...
Correct.
Yeah.
That's, mm-hmm. It was dark money that came from the Agribusiness Association of Iowa, which met with executives of Monsanto and Koch Fertilizer. And we know that from our own reporting. So, yes, the lawsuit was dismissed, but the issue remains. In fact, we had a story last week before the Pulitzers were announced that the Raccoon River continues to redline with both nitrates and phosphorus, and that new health risks are being discovered from nitrates in our water, our surface water, and that includes thyroid cancer, ovarian cancer. So we're continuing to report the story, and we're going to continue to editorialize that we need a new sense of stewardship in Iowa that accommodates modern agricultural production systems.
Art Cullen, co-owner and editor of the Storm Lake Times in Storm Lake, Iowa, 2017 Pulitzer Prize winner for his editorial writing. And Art, something tells me that you are not stopping on this topic.
No, we just got on the horse.
Hey, thank you and congratulations again.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Even the family dog comes into the newspaper office to work. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.